Governor Kristi Noem says she wants to bring prayer back into schools. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday, July 21st, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour for our Dakota Political Junkies conversation, we're welcoming Dave Wiltsey and Lisa Hager, two political scientists from South Dakota State University. We'll talk about Noem's remarks at the Family Leadership Summit. We'll also ask how much her comments about hating Joe Biden's America might damage or bolster her image. We explore Crazy Horse Memorial from a new perspective that seeks to help visitors understand the sacred Black Hills. Plus, Megan Feary introduces you to a new class of COVID entrepreneur. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
For SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson. A fraternity of the far-right extremist group Proud Boys has withdrawn its sponsorship of a street dance in Scotland in September. David Finnell applied on behalf of the group to have the street dance for noon until midnight September 18th in the Bonham County community. The City Council approved the request to close a section of the city street as required for alcohol consumption and food vendors. Finnell, in a Facebook message to Kello TV Monday, said that the Proud Boys were dropping sponsorship of the event out of concerns for safety. He did not elaborate. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem is one of more than 100 speakers on the program at Freedom Fest. Rapid City hosts the annual event for the first time beginning today. The event is held at the Monument Civic Center and organizers anticipate about 2,600 people. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has a preview.
The festival is billed as the largest liberty event in the world. The agenda includes a wide range of topics, from the Second Amendment to education, cryptocurrency, reparations, and a panel on decriminalizing sex work. Speakers include actor Dennis Quaid, Utah Senator Mike Lee, Governor Kristi Noem, and others. Mark Skousen is the founder of Freedom Fest. He calls the event the largest gathering of free minds.
We've met for the last 14 years in Las Vegas every July, and it's really been a lot of fun. We attract several thousand people from the United States and all over the world, and we talk politics, philosophy, history, science and technology, healthy living, music, dance. It's a little bit of everything.
Skousen says the festival is branching out from Las Vegas and chose South Dakota because of the pandemic. He says the state has the fewest restrictions. Freedom Fest will return to Las Vegas every other year, but be held in other American cities. Skousen says the event may trend libertarian, but is centered around civil discourse and debate over ideas.
We're trying to achieve best solutions rather than name-calling and the labeling that goes on. We try to discourage that as much as possible. So everybody feels welcome. We've had people across the political spectrum say, you know, it was really nice to have my point of view presented without someone yelling at me or saying I'm a racist or whatever the term may be to criticize people. And we desperately need that in this country.
The event costs $400 for South Dakota residents to register. Media representatives pay $150, and a live stream of the sessions costs $125. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
A former South Dakota prison official who was recently fired by Governor Kristi Noem says she wasn't told why she was dismissed. Jennifer Dreisk, the former deputy warden at the state penitentiary in Sioux Falls, had worked at the Department of Corrections for 19 years, until Noem announced Thursday that she was being fired along with the prison's warden, Darren Young. The Department of Human Services has been investigating an anonymous complaint that alleged the supervising corrections officers regularly sexually harassed their colleagues, that employee morale was low, and that promotions were plagued by nepotism. Dreisk says Tuesday in a statement on Facebook that she never wavered in her duties, but that she was fired without an explanation. Today's weather report shows this afternoon with highs in the low to mid-90s across the state, with haze blanketing the west. Tonight, the haze will persist in Rapid City area with lows in the 70s. Tomorrow, the highs will reach in the upper 80s across the state, with a slight chance of thunderstorms in the west, with haze persisting throughout the day. With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson.
I'm Lori Walsh. In 2017, the U.S. Congress passed what was known as the Over-the-Counter Hearing Aid Act. The FDA was directed by President Trump to establish standards for implementation of the act. Those efforts were delayed by COVID. Well, on July 9th, President Biden ordered the process to be expedited. Guidelines are supposed to be released within 120 days of the president's executive order. Dr. Jennifer Phelan is assistant professor and audiology clinic coordinator at the University of South Dakota Speech and Hearing Clinic. She's joining us now on the phone to talk about the demand for over-the-counter hearing aids, what you need to know before you shop, and the importance of hearing evaluations in this whole process. Dr. Phelan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Lori.
Tell us a little bit about the demand for over-the-counter hearing aids. Is this an expense problem, an insurance problem? Where did this all begin?
Yeah, so I think hearing aids as a medical device, they don't have the penetration in the market that even myself as a hearing healthcare provider would like to see. Mm-hmm. The statistics say that 28.8 million U.S. adults could benefit from hearing aids. And from the patients I work with, it's different things. Sometimes it's stigma or it can be cost. And so there's a variety of different reasons why someone might personally not get hearing aids. But moving to an over-the-counter product, our hope is that it gives us the opportunity to serve more of the public and to get hearing healthcare services out to people.
The over-the-counter product versus a prescription model, is there a difference in the device itself?
There absolutely is. An over-the-counter hearing aid product is going to be, from what we've been told, labeled for individuals with mild to moderate hearing loss. The hard part is, without a hearing evaluation, someone isn't going to know if that's them. And so without a hearing evaluation, people are going to end up going on the perception of how they feel like their hearing is, which, you know, for some people may be accurate. Where I think over-the-counter hearing aids are really going to be the most helpful is for someone like myself. After a hearing evaluation as the hearing healthcare provider, I can talk to my patients and give them more options. And that really is where I see the biggest opportunity for us, and I'm excited to see what the proposed rules are.
Yeah. So you're going to be looking at what from a device where you can tell a patient, I really think you could probably save some money after the hearing evaluation by looking for an over-the-counter product. But what kind? I mean, it seems like there could be all kinds of different devices out there depending on what the regulations are.
Absolutely. And I think that's going to be one of the biggest things that we'll be looking at is what do these devices, what are they actually doing? Because currently right now, there are products out on the market, personal sound amplification products or PSAPs that amplify, they make things louder. And our goal with looking at the hearing aids is hopefully being able to say, these are products that are regulated. We trust them. This is going to help you. And where the regulation is, there aren't hopefully going to be this plethora of product out there. And we're really going to be able to say to a person, this is what's going to be best for your type of hearing loss.
I think of sitting in the eye doctor and, you know, saying one or two, three or four,
yes.
And just how
yep.
fine-tuned that is compared to the experience of picking up a pair of readers at a drugstore and saying, well, this helps a little bit. But I go to the eye doctor every year, and I've never been to an audiologist as part of my regular health care. When is the time to reach out to have a hearing evaluation?
So I think having a hearing evaluation is important when someone is an adult. We don't do hearing screenings regularly. For adults, we always think about it as something we did in elementary school.
Right.
And, you know, it really is great for any adult to have a baseline, even if they don't feel like they're having a lot of difficulties. Their hearing evaluations, often the evaluation part is covered by insurance. And I tell people having a baseline is a wonderful thing because then if it changes through the years, we know that change. Mm-hmm. And so really being able to do that as an adult and know, definitely if someone feels like they're having more difficulty, if they're having difficulty hearing in noise or in conversations with their family and feel like they're missing out, they absolutely should have a hearing evaluation. patients. And that's my job. My job is to do an evaluation, get diagnostic information so that I can provide my patients with the most information they can have to make the best healthcare decisions for themselves.
Yeah. Anything else you wanted to lay out as we wait for these guidelines to be released, really within 100 to 120 days is what we're expecting those guidelines to be. Final thoughts?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is for people to recognize that currently there is no product that can claim to address hearing loss that's out there. Mm-hmm. And it really is a great opportunity to get that baseline. So when these products come out, you will be able to, you know, take advantage of them and ask your hearing healthcare provider all the questions that you have to make an informed decision.
Yeah. Dr. Jennifer Phelan, Assistant Professor and Audiology Clinic Coordinator at the University of South Dakota Speech and Hearing Clinic. Jennifer, we appreciate your time. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Lori. I appreciate it.
Ahead on the program, how much will Governor Kristi Noem's comments about hating Joe Biden's America hurt her candidacy? Well, that might depend on what you think she's a candidate for. The Dakota Political Junkies discuss. But first, SDPB's Megan Feary introduces you to the new class of entrepreneurs bolstered by South Dakota's COVID policy. That's ahead on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
I'm Robin Young. A decade ago, a Canadian man traded a paperclip for an item of higher value and kept going until he ended up with a house. Trading up, bartering. We'll talk to two students trying to pay off their loans.
It quickly just kept escalating, went to a snowboard, a smart thermostat, to an Apple HomePod, and then a Canon camera bundle.
Next time, Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota, a catalyst for creative and artistic expression in communities and schools throughout South Dakota. Advancing the arts through education, service, and advocacy. More at artssouthdakota.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Amir Questlove Thompson talks about directing the new film Summer of Soul, documenting the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival. It features performances by Nina Simone, Stevie Wonder, Mahalia Jackson, and others, and reflects on the cultural and political changes of the time. We'll also talk about big changes in Questlove's life. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding with your support and by Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie, sharing Laura Ingalls Wilder's pioneer heritage through covered wagon rides and hands-on activities. Online at IngallsHomestead.com.
Business and community development reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at SDNCommunications.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. A new generation of COVID entrepreneurs is making its way in the business world. Many restaurant owners struggled to stay afloat when pandemic restrictions limited business, but others have started new ventures. That's because South Dakota's response to COVID-19 presented a unique opportunity, one that wasn't possible everywhere. SDPB's Megan Feary has more.
Alessio DiSabatino grew up in Rome. He's lived in the U.S. for more than 25 years, mostly in California, where he owned a restaurant. He sold it in March 2020, right before that state shut down.
So I had a chance to decide where I want to go to my life.
DiSabatino moved to Rapid City. He visited once and loved it. He found a restaurant space immediately. Last November, he opened an authentic Italian restaurant downtown.
Local community support us so much. And I love the state, I love the people, I love the hair, I love everything about it.
He named it Sabatino's, after himself. And he says business is going well. It's hard to get a table on weekends. But as much as DiSabatino loves South Dakota, he came here for another reason.
South Dakota was the only state open in America. So nobody wore a mask, we didn't have any problem.
South Dakota never issued statewide business shutdowns or mask requirements. DiSabatino likes Governor Cristino, says she's doing a great job. He has no complaints about how she handled the pandemic. His business challenge comes in another form.
The only problem that we find here in Santa Clara is employees. It's hard to find them because they get paid to stay home and they don't want to work.
Hiring workers isn't a problem for everyone. Darcy Green is a one-woman operation.
I shop, I cook, I prep, I chop, I box, I get in my car, I deliver, I load, I unload.
She started Brosia Bowl last year in Brookings. It's entirely vegan. Customers in the area can order meals online, and Green delivers right to their door. She already had plans to start the business before the pandemic hit, but then city leaders imposed temporary restrictions on local businesses and restaurants. Green saw an opportunity.
And I was like, I guess we're delivering hardcore now. So I just told as many people as I could, I'm like, I deliver and I deliver for free. Because at that point, it was so early in this pandemic, restaurants hadn't figured out the delivery thing yet.
It worked. She was swamped with orders, and she thinks she knows the reason why.
Sorry to say, but I am one of those ones who did benefit from things closing down because I was willing to mask up and glove up. I think people really appreciated the steps that I was taking to make sure that I was cautious.
Green says she's grateful. She knows how hard some restaurants struggled last year, but she had bills to pay, so she went for it. Green says the pandemic made her more serious about her business because there was no backup plan. That feeling is actually pretty common during times of recession.
Some of it, unfortunately, is forced, where some people lost their jobs. No better time to be thinking about what's my next professional move. Maybe I should start this business. I've been sitting on this idea for the last 10 years.
That's Brian Maynor. She's the executive director of Startup Sioux Falls. It's a nonprofit that offers support and resources to entrepreneurs. She says when the pandemic hit, her staff geared up.
Our last major recession back in 2008 was when some of the greatest entrepreneurial ventures of our time were formed. So for us, and I hate to say this, we saw it as an opportunity.
But Maynor says the pandemic differed from the Great Recession.
It was a really difficult thing for so many of us to navigate because there were no cut and dry rules as to what you could do.
There were no statewide COVID restrictions. Some cities and counties issued public health requirements. Still, many business owners had to decide for themselves what to do. Sarah Benson opened the Hello High last fall. It's a cocktail bar in Sioux Falls. She and her business partner signed their lease in February 2020.
So little did we know that there would be a global pandemic. That wasn't part of the plan.
Things got messy. Benson says they had to change a lot of their original plans. The opening was delayed for months, and when they finally did open, they implemented a strict mask policy.
What was seemingly a pretty public health issue got pretty political very quickly. You were very visibly telling people what you thought on certain issues.
Benson says their mask requirement was designed to keep their staff safe. Most customers respected the guidelines, but not all. Some people walked out when asked to wear a mask. A few got confrontational, even threatened violence. The bar received some negative online reviews. Benson was frustrated. However, she realizes the new cocktail bar owes its existence to the fact that South Dakota never shut down. Despite everything, Benson is proud of her decisions. She wouldn't change a thing. Except maybe next time, she won't open a new business during a global pandemic. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Megan Feary.
You can find and share this story on our website, sdpb.org/news. Ahead on the program, well, what about that COVID-19 response? And how is it impacting Governor Noem's message as a candidate? That might depend on what you think she's a candidate for. The Dakota Political Junkies are next on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
The National Endowment for the Arts has announced the latest class of NEA Jazz Masters.
They include bassist Stanley Clark, drummer Billy Hart, vocalist Cassandra Wilson, and saxophonist Donald Harrison Jr. The NEA Jazz Master's designation is considered the highest honor reserved for a living jazz artist in the U.S. I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear recordings from these four jazz masters. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding provided by First Dakota National Bank, supporting the businesses and individuals with a dream and the passion and drive to make it a reality. What will be your South Dakota first? More at firstdakota.com/first.
Join your friends and neighbors by keeping SDPB strong. Become a $10 a month sustaining member and gain access to SDPB Passport. It's an on-demand library of hundreds of PBS and South Dakota Public Broadcasting shows, your favorites on your time. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
Program funding by Bangs McCullen Law Firm. From humble beginnings in the Dakota Territory over 130 years ago, now a full-service firm with offices in Sioux Falls and Rapid City. There for you then, here for you now. BangsMcCullen.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Did Governor Kristi Noem misstep when she said she really hates this America under President Biden? She was at the Family Leadership Summit last weekend in Des Moines. At the same conservative gathering, Noem also said she is putting prayer back in our schools. Today, our Dakota Political Junkies segment is going to have us looking at national politics through a South Dakota lens. Our guests, Lisa Hager, Assistant Professor of Political Science at South Dakota State University. Dr. Hager, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
David Wiltsy is with us as well. He's Associate Professor of Political Science also at SDSU. Dr. Wiltsy, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Let's start with this notion of putting prayer back in schools. This was a comment that Governor Noem said, and some reporters checked up with her on it, and they said, her office said, stay tuned. What do you make, and we'll start with you, Lisa, what do you make of this a prayer back in schools thing when we know that the United States Supreme Court has dealt with this issue really since, I think, what, the 1960s? Or what do you make of it?
Right. Yeah, I was really somewhat taken aback by Governor Noem's comments relating to prayer in schools, because the Supreme Court, over a variety of different decisions, but beginning with Engle v. Vitale in 1962, eliminated prayer in schools. And, I mean, it has been criticized over time because they haven't required any sort of coercion to pray to be a requirement to demonstrate that there's been a violation of the Establishment Clause, but they've been very consistent over time with not allowing any sort of prayer in school, whether that would be something that would be required or coerced or something that is more voluntary in nature. Mm-hmm. And that's just continued over time, with some of the more recent decisions being in the 2000s. So I really would be curious to see what sorts of plans she has in place, and I would definitely expect litigation to follow.
And this is another interesting thought about that, and Dave, maybe you could spin off of this. You know, she's talking here in context, saying, you know, I don't really recognize the country I had the opportunity to grow up in. I'm quoting her here. When I grew up, people were proud to have a job. They weren't confused on the difference between boys and girls. We prayed in school, which, by the way, in South Dakota, I'm putting prayer back in our school. We stood for the national anthem. Governor Noem is at roughly my age. She's a little bit younger than I am by like a year and a half or so. I wasn't allowed, and this is all after that, this 1962 Supreme Court decision. I never prayed in school. I don't think it was something that we did when we were kids. So what is she getting at here by putting all these things together and saying this is the America that we want to have once again?
Yeah, in many ways, this is just kind of an imagined community, an imagined past that she's trying to build nostalgia for. I mean, these are very powerful, emotional pleas, and these are the kinds of things that a certain portion of the Republican primary electorate will really gobble up. I mean, you're precisely right. I grew up in the Midwest at exactly the same time she did. And, you know, Engel versus Vitale and a few other cases, you know, took care of this a decade before I was born. So this really is just an attempt to construct this image of an idealized America that is, you know, red meat to a certain generation and to a certain portion of that electorate.
To this point of, you know, I'm the first candidate who signed on to the 1776 pledge, or, you know, stay tuned, South Dakota, I'm putting prayer back in our schools. She is also sort of dangling in front of us this, you know, keep paying attention. We're not really sure what she's a candidate for. We know she's a candidate for South Dakota governor. She has said she's not interested in running for president, but all indications seem to point toward a national campaign. Lisa, tell me a little bit about the concept of just keeping the attention where you want it to be as you fundraise for your campaign, as you try to get your initiatives across. How much of this is just staying in the national spotlight, staying in a conversation on the airwaves here at home?
I think that's a lot of what we're seeing here with Governor Noem, and I think it basically gives her that opportunity to possibly dip her toe in the pool of possibly running for president. So even if she says, I'm not interested in running for president, as a politician, it's always better to have your name in the mix and then choose not to run and know that it's an opportunity that you could pursue in the future than to have no one talking about you, nobody thinking that you would be a viable candidate. And I think that's one of the reasons why we see her talking about all of these different idealized views of America that Dave was talking about, to try to continue capturing the attention of the news media, but particularly Republicans, and why she's talking about how, you know, stay tuned, South Dakota, we're going to be essentially being this laboratory of democracy to kind of see, hey, can any of these sorts of things stick, especially in a more conservative state. Kind of typical of what we see of women running for office who are Republicans in Republican states. They tend to really kind of focus on policy a lot more and then their experience. So by doing some of these things, she's also trying to highlight her experience as a leader.
Yeah. All right. So many people have pointed out during a Dakota Political Junkie segment or in other media outlets that often Governor Noem will tie in her appearances and speeches to something that you could really easily pin next to tourism. And, you know, it might be, you know, we didn't shut down, our parks are open, you know, we're open for business, come for our economy. Fireworks over the 4th of July at Mount Rushmore is a reminder to everyone that Mount Rushmore exists and is this monument to American history. When I look at these comments, it seems like there's not a real tag to something specifically in South Dakota other than this is the kind of culture that we have. Dave, am I missing anything here? Or what's the value from a, you know, move here, relocate here, open your business? She's not talking about taxes. She's not talking about, you know, business-friendly climate. What do you think?
I don't think this really has anything to do with promoting the state in general. That's just something she can conveniently fall back upon if questioned about. Very rarely does somebody declare 2.5 years before the Iowa caucuses or the New Hampshire primaries. This is about what we call the invisible primary in political science, where people who are interested in running are really courting their party, particularly party office holders across the country, to try to build their brand, build their name, and put themselves in a position where they can get other office holders and their networks within the parties, within the party behind them, come primary time. So this really is classic behavior that we see from anyone who is thinking about running for office. And like Lisa said, you know, it might not be about running for president specifically, but it opens up other opportunities. I mean, she would love to, I'm sure, get a position within the cabinet, perhaps a vice presidential nomination, you know, who knows? But it's really about building her personal brand within the party as we enter into the next election cycle.
Let's talk about how the South Dakota pandemic response influences that brand, because there was an opinion article in the Washington Post comparing Vermont, also Republican governor-led, and South Dakota. Both have very low unemployment rates. Vermont's is a tick better than South Dakota's, but not much. Vermont has 75% of their residents vaccinated. South Dakota is hovering, you know, above the 50%, the 51% range still as far as, you know, completing vaccines. But yet Vermont had significantly fewer deaths. 250 Vermont residents died and were over 2,000 in South Dakota. So when we talk about building that brand, and what Governor Noem says, Lisa, about the response and being open for business as she kind of throws shots at Governor from Florida and others, how are we seeing this narrative of South Dakota's response unfold as we look at incoming Delta variant, as we look at the vaccine rate, as we look at our overall death rate?
Right. Yeah, we're not really going to, or at least I don't expect to see Governor Noem change her approach to handling the COVID-19 pandemic with the Delta variant coming in. Obviously, there is the argument that could be made of you've got, you know, halfway decent vaccination rates, and given the prevalence of COVID-19 in South Dakota, there's the possibility that many of those who are not vaccinated did come into contact with it and possibly do have antibodies. We'll just kind of have to wait and see how the Delta variant impacts South Dakota. But I think she's able to draw a distinction between how she handled the pandemic and how other governors handled the pandemic, and make that case for, you know, hey, voters, which kind of approach do you prefer? And again, it allows her to enter that national conversation on a variety of topics where she seems to be focusing most on COVID-19, but also some of these typical culture wars sorts of issues here, and, you know, keep her name active in the conversation for, like what Dave was mentioning, possibly a cabinet position if a Republican would win the next presidential election or maybe a vice presidential nomination.
Dave, how do you think with Delta variant and the fact that so many South Dakotans were infected and so many more died, that in a place like Vermont, which is really, Seth Tupper from South Dakota Public Broadcasting was making this comparison fairly early on, and it seems to be, you know, gaining some traction, what happened in Vermont versus what happened in South Dakota? It's becoming a more popular comparison. Does it matter for someone like Governor Noem?
It matters in that how she is going to really position herself and try to appeal to Trump's coalition if she does run for office. And this is going to be a big challenge for all of these potential candidates. Trump kind of had a unique coalition that he came into office on. And these, you know, none of these candidates are running exactly like he did, but they're trying to pick up certain themes, pick up certain qualities that Trump was running on, and they see him successfully running on. But I don't know if this is going to cut it for them in the end. They have some real challenges here. And if you just use the 2020 election results and the way that Trump ran on COVID, as opposed to the way that Joe Biden ran on COVID, you know, you get the sense that this might not resonate as well as they think it will. I mean, it obviously plays very well within the Republican primary electorate, but when it comes time to run in the general, I don't know if that's going to work in states like Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania again, and perhaps even a state like North Carolina or Georgia, where the president narrowly either won or lost those states in 2020. So this is going to be challenging for her and for any of these folks who are contemplating a run.
One of the things that I think is fairly obvious is that there were many people who have been active on social media and vocal critics of Governor Noem and have accused the loss of life, you know, tried to pin it directly to her, like your policies led to this, which is always a challenging thing to say or do. But I'm wondering if both of you can give us some historical context for that. Are there other, you know, candidates in history that, you know, where people said,
I don't know, you know, this many American soldiers died because of your decision, or this many people suffered because of your decision. I'm like, does this ever stick to her for the people who are critics of the death rate in South Dakota and want to have it tied very closely to her, are frustrated that it's not? Does it stick to her? What do we know from the past that could help us predict what might happen in the days ahead? Lisa?
I think that you frequently see those sorts of things, particularly when you look at foreign policy and America's involvement in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, lots of discussions about the loss of life under the George W. Bush administration, more so not while it was happening imminently after 9/11, but as it continued to drag on, there were lots of discussions about how, well, why do we have this loss of life? Well, look at where it's, you know, continued to spiral since those initial decisions to fight terrorism. But at the same time there, you still have the idea that, well, terrorism is bad. We do need to be trying to do something about it, try to contain it. You know, we had the terrorist attack of 9/11. We had to try to go after Osama bin Laden. You know, you still have some of these other narratives that are operating that do make it hard to say, well, this loss of military life is specifically due to George W. Bush. You know, a pandemic is slightly different in the sense that, you know, policies could have been put in place to try to curb that. But, I mean, there were times where we saw policies being put in place in other states and people were violating it. So I personally find it somewhat hard for that to stick, but I think it is going to be something that any candidate running who had a more kind of open door policy with respect to COVID-19 is going to have to deal with when they're trying to appeal to Democratic voters and those more middle-of-the-road voters like Dave was talking about.
Yeah. Dave, any final thoughts here for our conversation today?
Yeah, I would say that as tempting as it is for people to put these grand narratives onto an individual election and say that issue X was what drove the election, the political science literature is pretty clear that it is very hard to make these kinds of claims. In these kinds of talks and mandates on this, that, or the other, about the only thing that we really know that is a constant looming presence in people's minds is the state of the economy. So I would be very hesitant to come out and say that, yes, COVID or any other single issue is really going to be driving this next election. Mm.
Lisa Hager is Assistant Professor of Political Science at South Dakota State University. Dave Wiltsey is Associate Professor of Political Science at SDSU. The Dakota Political Junkies, it's a weekly feature on In the Moment. We tap the expertise every Wednesday right about 12:20 Central, 11:20 Mountain. Lisa, thanks so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dave, thanks again.
Thank you.
Let's take a moment now to honor inductees into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. The enshrinement ceremony for the 2020 class has been scheduled for September 10th and 11th of this year. Bruce Longfox has joined the 2020 class of inductees. He studied at Dartmouth College for 3 years before transferring to the University of South Dakota in Vermilion. Longfox has been influential in his work with the Rural America Initiatives for more than 3 decades. His work has centered around helping students finish high school and be good community members. He joined us on In the Moment August 18th, 2020.
Well, I always give thanks to the educators in my life because it was my fourth grade teacher that got me tested. I used to sleep through class all day because I was bored, and people thought I was, you know, maybe a little slow. And it turned out that I had a ninth grade reading level and a ninth grade math level. And so I went from being labeled, special needs to one that, was a little more intelligent. Father Vine Deloria was my family priest when I was a kid. And he, in 1970, arranged for me to go to a a prep school out about 79 miles north of Washington, D.C., and I got a full scholarship. But I did get a master's degree from the University of South Dakota, and I had, excellent instructors there. I tutored three middle schools, and that's where I learned to work with kids. I did a lot of math, and math was a subject that not a lot of other Indians excelled in. They assigned me almost every Native kid that was having trouble, and I enjoyed working with them. I think I try to teach the kids both of those. They learn strength and resilience from the Lakota side, and they learn achievement just by study. I like to be near my family and be near the Lakota people. I always had what I'd call a heart for the people.
Ahead on In the Moment, we take you off the beaten path to experience Crazy Horse Memorial from a different perspective on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
Over two-thirds of U.S. adults have now received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, but coronavirus infections in the U.S. are going up.
If you are in a area where you have a high level of infection and a very low level of vaccinated people, the chances in that environment of getting infected are reasonably high.
More from Dr. Anthony Fauci this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Help wanted.
We need more people to help with customers, more people to help make the chocolate, more people to help tie little pretty ribbons on boxes.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We like the sugar rush, so they need a hiring rush. We'll tell you that story next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
As part of our Early Learners Initiative, or ELI, SDPB presents Parenting Minutes. These bite-sized videos for parents and caregivers have useful everyday tips for raising curious and confident learners. There's always time to learn. Watch for Parenting Minutes on SDPB TV or visit us online at sdpb.org/ELI. And don't forget to sign up for our ELI newsletter.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. A new program at Crazy Horse Memorial aims to help visitors understand the importance of the Black Hills to the Lakota and other Native nations. Visitors are invited to experience the sacredness of the Black Hills through an educational walk called Makoshegi, which is Lakota for the land. Daryl Redcloud is a faculty member at Oglala Lakota College and an outdoor program educator at Mount Rushmore Memorial, and he's joining us now from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Daryl, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, good day. Good day to you guys, and I'm happy to be on.
Tell us the correct pronunciation of this program, please, because I have a feeling that yours is a little more authentic than mine.
Okay. The word Makoche means land. Gi, with a nasalized N, similar to the French language, I would say, which means the land. Gi is the, and Makoche is land. And, of course, the Lakota translate, when you translate into English, it's usually backwards, but it's pronounced Makoche Gi.
Thank you for a little lesson there. And in the month of August, SDPB's spotlight coverage is going to be all about the Black Hills National Forest, as it's called today. But that
history goes back far before any kind of European contact, far before the Custer expedition. How do you explain to visitors the Black Hills if someone were just to say, you know, tell me the history of this place?
I try to share as much history as I can pertaining to the Native people that utilized the Black Hills as a home during the fall and the winter, and then share with them the sacred sites and what the Black Hills mean to our people whenever we're walking through the forest, and sharing bits and pieces of the plant life, stories of animals, and what the plant life means to our people. So it's like the Native people have strong ties to the Black Hills, which is very, very meaningful for our people and other indigenous tribes that utilize the Black Hills sometime or another throughout time.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about this program at Crazy Horse Memorial, how people can participate in it, and what they might learn.
The program Makoche Ki is a program to help the visitors that come to Crazy Horse Memorial to get off the beaten path and imagine and use their inner spirit to fill the land by taking a walk into the forest and experiencing some of the stories that our people have handed down from generation to generation about the land and what it means to our people, the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota people, because our origin story exists, and we say we come from the Black Hills. And you can find this program every Friday, last Friday of the month. You can go online or go to some of the social media apps and find the program on there as well. And you could sign up once you get there. And there's a limited amount of people. I would say maybe 30 to 40 people twice a day at 10 o'clock in the morning and 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Is there a story you can share with us today that would help our listeners kind of stand in this space, at least from an audio perspective?
our people, they go back and they say that our origin story, they say we come from the great spiritual realm into this spiritual realm within the Black Hills through a place called Wind Cave. Onia Waka, they say in our language. And there they say that everything existed in harmony with one another. All the animals and the beings of different kinds, including mankind. And there was a great race that happened around the Black Hills. And everything ran on this great racetrack. And to see who was going to become the dominant species, and all the animals, the insects of different kinds, the winged, the two-legged, even the four-legged, the pawed, the hooved animals, they all ran on this great racetrack all the way around. And as they were coming to the end, and then the buffalo was in lead, very strong. And just as he was ready to cross the line, they say that the magpie that sat on his hump behind his ear flew across the line and won the race for the two-legged and the winged. And after everything settled down, then the magpie called upon mankind. Mankind, we would like to honor you today to become the dominant species to walk upon Mother Earth. Since you have a bigger brain than we do, since you understand Creator's way about his spiritual place, that we must exist in harmony with all of creation. So mankind steps up and he takes that honor. From then on, mankind became the dominant species to walk upon Mother Earth. And that is part of our origin story. And we have stories that go on and on and on and on. And it's a never-ending story of how our people came from, where they came from, and how we are supposed to honor and walk upon Mother Earth in a good way, in harmony with all of creation, the plants, the animals, the wind, the water, everything that has life, that is how we're supposed to acknowledge it and walk in harmony with everything upon Mother Earth. Hmm.
Daryl Rutcloud, what a gift. Thank you so much for being here with us today. You can find more information if you're just tuning in at the Crazy Horse Memorial social media feed. We'll put some information up on our website as well at stpb.org/news. Thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
From live music to yoga, arts and crafts, open mics, slam poetry, and film screenings, the Cave Collective is dedicated to the cultural well-being of the Rapid City area. The Cave is located on 5th Street in Rapid City. It's an all-ages gathering spot for big dreamers. And joining me now, we have Dexter Carman, Executive Director of the Cave Collective, and Mary Hahn, who is Board President. Dexter, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Mary, thanks for being here as well.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure.
This is, I was looking at your website today, exciting stuff happening from mental health to live music to places to gather and have open, you know, poetry slams, open mics. Tell us a little bit where this idea came from, Dexter.
Yeah, so it all started with Natasha, who is our co-founder, who has been doing shows out at the Nameless Cave for almost a decade now. And those shows were house shows, which is a big thing in like the DIY underground music scene. And then it got to be so big, we were having, you know, 40, 50 people show up at our house, and parking was becoming an issue. So we decided to open a venue in town. And so that was the location over on 7th Street. And we were on 7th Street for about a year. And then right when it was time to renew our lease, COVID hit. And so we decided to close our doors for a period of time, did a lot of live stream programming in that period of time, did the Black Hills Drive-In, which was our big fundraiser we did at the drive-in theater here in Hermosa. And then now we just on May 1st opened up our new location here on 5th Street, and it's been really incredible just to watch this natural evolution from an idea. We weren't really sure when we first opened it how it was going to go, and it's just exploded beyond our wildest dreams.
Mary, tell me about the energy of it.
Well, I really love it. I have been in the service industry in some capacity for the last 15 years of my life. And so bringing a all-ages coffee shop to downtown Rapid City in a way that provides employment for young people, provides a safe space for young people, and just offers something for people of all backgrounds and demographics has been a dream come true for me. And so to see kids walk in the door and just make the space their home has been definitely my favorite part of it, just to have them come up to me and say, you know, like, thank you for building this space for us. Like, we feel like we belong here, and it's an important feeling for them.
Yeah. I want to get at this idea of this as an arts incubator, the sense that, like, if you are this age and you have a place to go and you're exposed to other people making music and writing poetry, that can lead to places that probably we haven't even imagined yet, right? Dexter, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so that's I've been playing music since I was about 12 years old, writing original music, and I never knew where to go with my music until I moved to Rapid and found out about there's a really amazing underground music scene here in Rapid City that I got to be a part of in my formative years. And I think for a lot of young people, there's a disconnect where that unless you're in a band that has a lot of followers, or you're in like a cover band and can play bars and things like that, you don't think that there's a place for your music in a place like Rapid City or in South Dakota. So in my experience, what I genuinely believe that there is a disproportionate amount of artistic talent compared to our population mm-hmm. concentrated in the Black Hills and South Dakota altogether. We're a very creative state. And so to give young people an opportunity to take their art and on a public platform and share it with the world is the greatest honor of my life. And it's so cool to see these young people really come into themselves on that stage.
Yeah. Mary, what are some of the things that are coming up for these summer months? Like, what are some of the highlights and where can people find out more from, I want to be a visitor and, you know, be in the audience to I have something to share?
Yeah. So we are at 406 Fifth Street, which you mentioned earlier, and we are open from 3 p.m. until 10 p.m. Monday through Saturday. We have just a full schedule of events. Like every night of the week, we have something going on. On Mondays, we have our DIY craft nights, and we're going to be booking out some shows on Monday nights as well for the fall. On Tuesdays, we have board game nights, and people can come down and play some games, meet new friends, and just kind of build community that way. Wednesdays are always our open mic nights. That starts at 7 p.m. You can come down and bring something to share or just enjoy some live entertainment that way. Thursdays, we have some rotating programming. So tomorrow night, for example, we have our slam poetry. We have an improv group that meets on the second Thursday of the month. We have a storytelling collective that meets on the first Thursday of the month. And Fridays and Saturdays, we've pretty much earmarked for live music and shows. And so we have everything from rap music to folk music to just new bands that have formed at the Cave Collective. And so it's local and touring acts that come through, and we get to just kind of participate in all of that and showcase it for the community.
Yeah. So I was just recently we had on the program a documentary filmmaker who was talking about, I think the film is called I Really Get Into It, talking about the punk scene in the 90s in the city of Sioux Falls, Nordic Hall and other places. So my question is, how well are you documenting what's happening right now? Because 20 years later, it's going to be really great to look back at some of what you're creating. Dexter?
Yeah, so we've been documenting everything pretty extensively. All of our events are live streamed on the Cave Collective Facebook page. We have a pretty robust live stream setup that we use, and we train young people how to operate all that. So we're training technical skills as well. So we have all that captured, and then we have two local filmmakers, Wyatt Bills and Destin Human, who are both working with us, who have been documenting things, and we actually have a film announcement that will be coming probably in a month or two that we're
the
really
nose for
about.
News here. The nose for news. We know it's coming. Well, come back then and tell us about it. If you like to watch or play music, drink coffee, recite poetry, hang out with your friends, create art or film, you can find more information at the Cave's website, thecavecollective.org. Dexter, Mary, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Lori.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Thanks to Megan Feary for her help with today's production. On the next In the Moment, politicians might have their own thoughts about education, but most parents just want to raise healthy, happy kids who aren't, you know, kind of jerks. We're going to offer some science-based strategies to help raise kids who aren't liars, who aren't narcissistic, who aren't bullies, who aren't racist. Author Melinda Wenner-Moyer is with us. Plus, Lee Strubinger reports on the next volley over critical race theory in South Dakota. For Steve Zwemke, Chris Loffrey, and Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.